Well, first of all, this was a uniquely difficult week for me, so just time-wise. So I did not sit down to write this actually until about 5:30 last night. That's not the way I like to do it, but that's the way it is. And so as I was going over it, it looks just so good when I wrote it. And then when I read it again this morning, I just started finding typos and mistakes. So I will do an on the job editing as I go, and then I'll try to upload a better set of notes for you. They're just mostly things like I started out with two extra duties I wanted to talk about with husbands, ended up with four, but I never corrected it, things like that. So bear with me as some of that will manifest itself as I preach. Now we last week moved into the application stage of marriage. Now all of this is good for us to hear, single or married, it doesn't matter. It's necessary for us to understand because there's an imagery taking place, according to Ephesians 5, within marriage that's incredibly important, that we are looking at, in fact, Christ and His church. And God has not left us without a witness regarding marriage, and so it is something that we should submit ourselves to as people of the book and people of our Lord, who has given us this book, the Bible. Now, we have established already for ourselves a sound theology on marriage. And it's only once you establish that theology that you can then move into the application, which is what we're really doing right now. I cannot overemphasize that enough for you. One basic rule of interpreting the Bible is to understand that any given passage, any given section has only one meaning. That's it. No other meaning. So if you're sitting in a Bible study and you got four different people telling you they think this is what it means and it's four different things, there's every bit of a chance that all four are wrong. At the very least, three of them are. There's only one meaning to the text. That's where you establish your theology, by drawing out from the text what the passage actually says and what it actually means. From there, you can consider applications to that, how that applies into your life. But the application must be faithful to the meaning. So that's why I spend all that time establishing the theology of the marriage so that we can finally get here and think about how that all works itself out. We have heard about the commands and the principles related to marriage, and we began last week to consider the duties connected to the two parties in a marriage, the husband and the wife. And we spent that whole hour looking at your responsibilities, men, as husbands. Now, today, we're going to spend a part of our time, not the bulk of our time, looking at the duties of the wife. In fact, I'm not even certain I'll get to the wife, depending on how I preach this. I want to pick up additional duties over the week that I thought about that were necessary for us to work through as men. One of the weird things that goes on within Christian marriages far too often is that the wife gets hyper-emphasized and the husband gets minimized as to their duties. And I don't want to make that error here, and I don't want to encourage that kind of a thinking in your own mind. I want the men to understand that they have tremendous responsibility in this marriage. And it's not my invention, but in fact, it's how God has established things to be. So I want to add these additional four duties, not two, with regard to what a husband ought to be. As a head of the house, you men are commanded to love your wife as Christ loves the church. That alone, if you just think about that, loving your wife as Christ loves the church, all sorts of duties and responsibilities as a husband become evident if you'll just spend time thinking, what does that look like with my manner of speech, my demeanor, my work ethic, my spending, theology, everything in your life. What does that look like in portraying Christ? And so as you think about the duties that I talked about last week, you'll find that every one of them really flowed out of that responsibility to love your wife as Christ loves the church and the reality that you have been made by God the head of the home. Whether you like it or not, you are the head of the home. All of those duties are just applications of those realities. Obviously, the greatest challenge that every husband has and every husband needs to continue to grow in until the day that he dies is to learn to preach Christ to his wife every way. So I'm going to give you four final duties that I think are important to add to the ones I gave to you last week, and I want you to take these on as well. The very first duty of a husband today is to be content with your wife. This is a huge one, and it's one that cannot be diminished. If you'll look at Exodus chapter 20, when I was in seminary, one of the things we had to do in a class was memorize. Well, we had like 1,000 passages we had to memorize, but we also had to be able to outline from memory the entire Bible, and then we had to identify key aspects. And one of the ways that I somehow just remembered the Ten Commandments in Exodus, it's twice that. It's Exodus 20, and in Deuteronomy, it's half of Ten Commandments. It's Deuteronomy 5. I don't know if you care, but to this day, I still remember where the Ten Commandments are because of that class. And in Exodus 20, we're dealing with the commandments of the Lord. They're not actually commandments, by the way. They're words. They're actually a big umbrella ideas that are describing the means and the way and the covenant that God has made with this nation. And in verse 17, it says, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or make his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to you, to your neighbor." So he is saying you are not to have this spirit, this heart of covetousness toward what your neighbor has. That word covet speaks of taking pleasure in or desiring. And it really, as I point out, or as the passage clearly makes it, it's not just coveting your neighbor's wife, but coveting anything that your neighbor has. And he's directing that toward the head of the house because he knows the heart of men. The idea of this is that in marriage, because you have two sinners who live together and interact with each other, sin is going to occur in your home. You already experience that if you're married. And there are times where you can become, as a husband, very frustrated with your wife for whatever reason. And imagine yourself back in the days of Israel, and you're out working in your field, and you see a man and his wife walk by, and you've just had an argument that you've had for the last week, and it's on your mind, and you're frustrated, and you see a husband and wife, and they're walking down a pathway, and you see them, and they're laughing, and they seem to be so happy, and you just begin to think, you know, if only, if I had, if this, if that. And you start to make those comparisons. And I'm telling you, men, it's deadly to do so. Jesus takes this all up to a whole different level in Matthew 5:28 when he says, if you look at a woman with lust, you have what? You've committed adultery in your heart. That when you take a woman and you make her into an object of your lust, your desires, and things that do not belong to you and things that are not proper for you when you view a woman, he says that you are already guilty within your heart of adultery. But not only that, in the book of Proverbs, there's an interesting passage in Proverbs chapter 5 that is very helpful, I think, because it describes this idea of being content with your wife in a very positive way. Proverbs chapter 5, verses 15 to 23. Solomon writes to his son, he says, "Drink water from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well." At this point, you think, what's he talking about? It becomes obvious. "Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth." So now we're starting to see that you're not supposed to be wandering with your eyes, your heart, or with your body with any other woman but your own. "As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he watches all his paths. And his own iniquities will capture the wicked, and he will be held with the cords of his sin, and he will die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray." in a very poetic way, Solomon just basically tells his son, don't you dare wander. Don't you wander and don't give away your strength to another person, a woman. The idea there is that she potentially can bear children, and all of a sudden your name is not a pure name, and you have these illegitimate children, and they also are your children. And he's just talking about the consequences and the folly of allowing yourself to wander away from the one that God has given you. He says, you be satisfied with your wife. Now, as I said, this is all done in a positive way of saying, you do this, don't do this, but instead let yourself be satisfied with your wife. And it's very important for us to remember that it's never sufficient for a man or a woman before the Lord to just be known for what he doesn't do or what she doesn't do, but we ought always to be known for the things that we delight in, the things that we are doing good. You are men to direct your care and concerns and your delights in just your wife. That's it. Now, there's all kinds of applications that I was tempted to go in. I'm just going to make brief application to this idea. First of all, men, if you are doing this, I am asking you, in the name of the Lord, just to stop immediately. Reject any comparison with any other woman that might create bitterness in your heart, discontentment, or mind that might wander into areas that ought not to be. Just stop it. You're not allowed there. So if you have allowed yourself to fall into that common trap of comparing your wife with others and wishing if only, you need to stop. Now, I've got a couple of subpoints to that. There is an exception. That doesn't mean, men, that you don't acknowledge that if a man has a wife who is particularly gifted in a certain area and your wife is lacking in that area, she's weak in that area, that you might not ask your wife, hey, why don't you set up an appointment to meet with so-and-so and see if you might learn how to do this better. In other words, as you're shepherding your wife, you might see that there are certain aspects that she's not strong in, and you see another woman that's strong in those areas, that person might be able to teach your wife. That's not a comparison. That's simply looking for the well-being of your wife. So I'm not saying that. On the other side, though, that we live in such a heavily sexualized world today that this whole comparison thing becomes huge. With the presence in every way, shape, or form of pornography in every possible venue, your wife finds herself, whether she even understands this or not, she finds herself battling something that she can't even hope to compete in. There are issues and ideas and images that are constantly being thrown at us. And unfortunately, within the lives of far too many men, old and young alike, they are willingly going and gazing at these things that are not for them to ever gaze at. And all it does is create this bitterness and this discontentment with your wife. And you ought never to put that upon your wife. And if you do, you need to repent of that. You need to be content with the wife that God has given to you. Do not make her compete with images and ideas and actions that are inappropriate to copy or impossible. You need to always remember, men, always, that you married a companion and a helper. That is who she is, and that you are to prize her for those things. She is not your consort, and she is not your plaything. One of the things I did with my son, I would encourage you fathers to do it with yours, is to be ruthless when you see your son disrespect his sisters and disrespect women in general. Our whole society disrespects them. You can't tolerate that. You train up a young man, as he gets older, it'll be more natural for him to understand that that woman is to be protected and to be cherished and to be guarded. You don't use your strength and you exploit yourself over her. All that will do is carry itself into the private lives as an adult, and it will cost you huge in the end. Solomon makes it clear that ultimately, if you choose not to heed this advice, if you choose to be discontent with your wife and pursue other women, whether it be in a physical, actual way of another woman, or you do it through pornography or anything else, you will ultimately be trapped in your own devices. The wickedness that you are practicing will be yours to own, and you will be held back, as he says, by the cords of his sin. And why? For the lack of instruction. So you're being instructed. Don't. It's not worth it. It's not good. There's nothing that you gain from it. You need to hate that with a holy hatred. How do you do that? Now, I could spend a whole message or two or three talking about the nature of sexual sin, the nature and the power and the presence of pornography in our nation. But husbands, do you want to know how you resolve this? It's not by trying to deal with getting rid of pornography. Yes, you need to do that. That's if you haven't figured that one out, I mean, you got bigger issues. You get busy doing the things we spent the entire hour last week talking about. You pour your life into preaching Christ to your wife every single day. You pour your life into nourishing your wife and cherishing your wife, living with her in an understanding way. You pour yourself into delighting in her. This is your task. This is your duty. And to the degree that you decide that I'm not going to see her as an addition into my life and an aspect of my life, but I also have my friends and my free time and I have my hobbies and this, but that she is your life, that she is what you exist to do and to care for, that you are to bring her up and to cherish her and create an environment for her to flourish. When you become busy doing that, you just won't have time for other things. And you will find, as a Christian man, if you're a Christian man here, that the Spirit will so work in your heart that the other things will become more distasteful for you. But as long as you wrongly view your wife and you wrongly view women in just general, you're doomed. You're just doomed. And so you have to fight that, and you have to fight it well. And when you get together, men, you encourage one another in those things. When you start to hear a man speak inappropriately of his wife or something, that you stop him. And you don't get all high and mighty. You just, in love, and as a care for him, you begin to exhort him in those things. So the first duty that you men need to do today and think about is be content with your own wife. And so if there's areas of discontentment as a Christian man, you need to identify those and confess them. Second duty is to approve. This is a completely different direction, so accept that. The second duty is to approve and to reject commitments. Go with me to Numbers. Now, how many times have you ever heard a message out of Numbers? Numbers chapter 30. Now, this is a passage for Israel. Understand that, and I know that. We are not under the law of Moses. It is not ours to obey. And yet, on the other side, when you're dealing with the law of Moses and you're dealing with the Old Testament commands, sometimes we take them and we say, well, that's for us to obey, but they're not. Those are for things that Israel was to obey. We are people of the New Covenant and therefore also the New Testament, and that's where we should be looking. But what do we do with two-thirds of the Bible, the Old Testament? One of the things that you need to remember when you're dealing with Old Testament law is that the same God who gave the law to Israel is the same God who is of the New Testament. They're not two different gods. And all the law is a reflection of the character of God. He didn't make these things up just because he had nothing better to do and just randomly assign laws for the people of Israel to keep and say, well, I don't really have a purpose behind this. It's just I don't want you to have two different kinds of cloth sewn together. You're not allowed to do that. I don't know why. Everything in the Old Testament law is a reflection of the character of God. And one of the things as a Christian that you can do is as you read the Old Testament law, this will help you in your Bible reading, because how many people die in the book of Numbers, right? You shouldn't, but you don't have to read every single name. Let your eyes scan over the lists of names, but you'll find little gems in those lists that are really neat. But the book of Numbers actually is filled with many, many good things. And as you're reading through the Old Testament law, you're like, oh my goodness, I'm so bored. No, you shouldn't be bored. Ask yourself, what is it that God is showing in this? What are the qualities of his character that he is manifesting? What does his people What are the things that his people are to reflect to the world around them? There was a reason why he told them that they couldn't be certain ways. It was in distinction with the nations around them so that they were a unique people and a holy people, uniquely distinct to Yahweh, the true God. So when you come to Numbers chapter 30, we have certain commands in relationship to the father and the husband, and oath-taking. So it says, then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, this is the word which the Lord has commanded. So we're back into the commands of the Lord. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. We'll stop there for a quick moment. In the Old Testament, when you make a vow, an oath, and you swear by the name of Yahweh, you have no option. You will keep that oath, which means you don't make rash oaths. Because once you make an oath to Yahweh, men, it was unbreakable for you. You had nothing but to keep it. This is why in Matthew chapter 5, 33 to 37, if you remember from the Sermon on the Mount, he says, don't make any oaths. Jesus talks about that. And people say, well, see, we're not supposed to take any oaths. But the context of it was, he says, if you swear by heaven or by earth or by your head of your head or whatever it might be, the hair on your head, he says, all of those things are still part of God's creation. Whether you swear in the name of Yahweh or you don't, you made an oath and you have to keep it. Because what people would do, what the Israelites figured out was, well, I won't make an oath in the name of Yahweh. I will just make an oath in something close to Yahweh. I swear by the heaven where Yahweh dwells that I will do such and such. Then they break it because they can figure a way around it. Well, I didn't actually swear by Yahweh. I swore by this and that. And that's all that Christ is confronting, is that deceitful, law-twisting, heart-deceiving attitude that was so prevalent in the nation at the time. The simple fact of the matter was that if you made men an oath in the name of Yahweh, you had no option but to keep it. But I want you to now notice what happens. Also, if a woman takes or makes a vow to the Lord or Yahweh and binds herself by an obligation in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then, so there's a whole bunch of ifs in there, right? If all of these, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father should forbid her on that day he hears of it, none of her vows or obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father had forgiven or forbidden her. So now we step into a whole different thing. When a daughter in the household of her father, and in that culture, you would never have a daughter just living out on her own. It was just she stayed within the household of her father and under his care and oversight until she was given in marriage. That was the way it was. So there's not this in-between status that we see within the American culture. I'm not saying one's better than another. I'm just saying that's how it was. For the woman who makes a vow, she has to keep it, but only if her father says nothing when he hears of it, or he expressly says yes, he approves of it. In other words, there's an unbreakable vow. The unbreakable vow is you cannot make a vow in the name of Yahweh. Once you do that, you have to keep it. With one exception, actually two. If a daughter makes it and her father says no, no you're not. It's broken. And the Lord allows it to be broken. This is describing incredible authority upon the father. Incredible authority. If his son makes a vow to Yahweh, he looks at him and says, sucks to be you, buddy. You should have thought, now you're going to do it. There's no option. That man, that young man, I don't care what his age is, he will keep that vow. But his daughter walks in and says, I made a vow, Dad. Well, really, you did? Yep. To whom? In the name of Yahweh. Okay, let me hear this. And she tells him, he's like, no. That's done. It's not even open for discussion. The father's authority was that great. And that was not something built into culture. That was given by the Lord. This is His commands. Well, now let's do that. My Nikki has made a vow. I think it's a great one. She marries. It says in verse 6, however, if she should marry while under her vows, or rash statement by her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing on the day he hears of it, then her vows shall stand and her obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day her husband hears of it, he forbids her, and he shall annul her vow which she is under and the rash statement by her lips which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. So here's a new scenario. The daughter comes into her father and says, I've made this vow before the Lord. The father either says nothing, and therefore it stands, or he says, yes, that's good. May the Lord bless you. And she is now under that vow. Let's give that 5 years now that she is under that vow that she has made before the Lord. Then she's married. And on the day that her husband finds out that she has made this vow, let's say that I have made the vow that I won't eat broccoli, something silly. And he says, you what? Yeah, 5 years ago I made a vow to Yahweh that I would not eat broccoli. And your dad was okay with that? Yep. I'm not. I mean, it's that simple. I'm not. No. You're eating broccoli. We need broccoli in this house. You know what? It's done. It's broken. The unbreakable vow becomes broken. And it's not a bad break. God honors it. God says she's released from this. In other words, the application in here is, it's not like he just decided, hey, I'm going to put this rule down there. There is, it's all built upon this idea of the headship of the husband, and therefore, by virtue of that, the headship over his entire house. That a wife is responsible to communicate to her husband promises and obligations that she has put herself under, and you as men and as husbands should be hearing these things and taking interest in these things and speaking then into your wife and giving her direction. In other words, the image that the Old Testament gives of the proper father-husband relationship is not something of apathy. Not something of disinterest or being disconnected from the goings-on in your household. Notice also that in this passage, it doesn't matter if the husband or father says something or doesn't say something. If you are so lazy that you choose not to speak to your daughter or your wife about a decision that she's made, it still stands. It's still there. It doesn't matter. Because by virtue of your headship, what you do always affects your home and always is in force. No husband, therefore, has the ability to say this. And I hear it too often, men. No husband ever has the ability to say it wasn't his responsibility. Men, it is always your responsibility. Every single time. I don't care what. It's your responsibility, so don't try to skirt it. So mom, dads, don't you raise up boys who make excuses. There's no value there. If you got a little boy and he's always excusing it, but there's no buts. No. No, not as a man, and you talk to him about it like that. Not as a man. You're a man. I don't care if he's little Matt's size. He's still a man. He's just got to grow up. And your job is to pour that into him, that he is a man. He is a man made by God, and he has responsibilities, and he needs to own it. There's nothing ever more pitiful in my thinking than looking at a guy who can't grow up and own his responsibilities. Moms, don't rescue your little boys. And when they get bigger, certainly don't rescue them. Let them eat the just desserts of their stupidity. Free pastoral advice. Let them suck the gutter water. It's good for them. They will come to their senses eventually. They're dense. They're slow sometimes. But usually because mom and dad, when they were four, were letting them get by with things and making excuses. Don't. Train a man to own his responsibility. Train him. Fathers, model that. Own your household. Own it fully. Be a man with a backbone and with a willingness to be decisive and own it. Man, you have no idea how you speak and preach to your sons and daughters every single day. Kim and I were poignantly aware that Maddie was going to marry his mom. I'm serious. In fact, every once in a while, Maddie and I will talk, and I'm like, you married your mom. She modeled for him the ideal woman. It's not unusual for a man to marry a woman who is much like his own or what he desired, because that's in his heart. And in the same way, guess what, daughters? You'll be amazed at how often you'll marry your father. There's quality. So men, women, model before your sons and daughters what they should be seeing in a father and in a mother and in a husband and a wife. And sometimes when you're in that marriage that's unequally yoked and you have an unbelieving husband or an unbelieving father, it doesn't matter. You be that model and that indication of what ought to be. Never allow your sons to make excuses, fathers. Whenever I hear a parent shrug and tell me, well, what can I do? I already know where the problem is. What you can do is train your son. And if you don't know how, we can sit down and talk and I'll tell you how to do that and help you with that. But you need to do it. It's your job. When I ask a husband if his wife is going to attend some event, Esme puts on a women's conference, and we make the announcement. And if you didn't know it, I always find out from Esme, or she'll let me know, hey, Matt, can you make an announcement and push this? I only have 15 ladies signed up. Oh, yeah, I'll push that. Can you give me a list of the names? And she gives me the list of the names. You know why I ask for the list of names? Because I'm going to start talking to some men. I want to find out from you why your wife's not attending. And you know how often I'll talk to a husband and say, hey, Esme sent me a list of the names. I noticed your wife's not signed up. And you know what I get? Not a, oh yeah, we talked about it and we have a commitment and we're not able to make it. That's not what I get usually. You know what I get? What? Yeah, you know, the women's conference. And you get this, oh, yeah, you weren't paying attention, were you? I'm like, the one we've been announcing for 2 weeks? Oh, your wife's not signed up. Oh, do you know why? No, why not? Why don't you know what your wife's doing or not doing? There's something wrong with that. See, it's got nothing to do with the wife. It's got to do with the husband. If you don't want your wife to attend the thing, then look at me and say, yeah, I don't want her to attend. Okay, I'll honor that. I may ask you why, but I'll honor it. It's your decision. But you should know what your wife is doing or not doing. You should be involved in a very intimate level. When a husband doesn't know about these things, I know where the problem lies. This also has application here for dating and marriage. Numbers 20 or 30, it was a passage that really helped frame Kim and I as we considered how we were going to approach the process of pursuing of men pursuing our daughters, and how we wanted Maddie to understand when he went to pursue a young lady, how the mindset and the attitude of it. Ultimately, men, you don't just send your daughters off on a date and just hope everything works out. That's an abdication of your responsibility. If you don't like the boy, guess what? That boy should have no chance. I actually threatened, and it was a good threat. I was going to do it. I knew I was going to go to jail for it, but I was going to do it. No, I did. You laugh. I mean, it got that tense in my office one day with a young man pursuing one of my daughters, and he wouldn't stop, and I told him, no, stay away. And he wouldn't. I looked at him, and I said, I see you next to my daughter one more time, I will break your jaw. And he laughed at me. I stood up, literally walked up and touched my nose to his face, and I said, try it. Now, you guys may laugh. You may think, oh, that's silly. That boy was going down. You're responsible for your daughters. You don't turn her loose and just hope things work out. You guard her. You protect her. You make the men come through you. And if they're such a wimp that they won't come through you, they don't deserve your daughter. Have them be a man. Raise up men who are not afraid. Don't raise up a son who then asks a friend to go talk to her friend to talk to her to see if she might be interested in him, so that then maybe he might then actually have the backbone to do it. Oh, goodness gracious, go grow up. I know I sound hard, but we have a culture today where what used to be a rite of passage at 16 to 18 is now in the 25s to 30s. And it's time to, for the Christian world to begin to roll that back. If you are interested in understanding more about the idea with a dating marriage, there's an excellent little book, and I would even go through it with you, called Her Hand in Marriage. If you're not interested, then never mind. In all of this, the point here is not small, and it's not simple. Husbands, you need to be engaged in your home in every way. You should be asking your wife what plans she has, what she's doing. When announcements for the church come up and it involves women, you should be listening. It's not time to just tune out. You should be asking yourself, is this something that would be good for my daughter? Is this something that would be good for my wife? Doesn't matter if your wife wants to or not. Is it good for her? Then you tell her you want her to go. All of this, I mean, I'm just using some personal application and illustrations to kind of show you how it worked out in my mind. It doesn't have to work out exactly in yours, but if you were to ask my wife, she'll tell you that these are the standards that we set. 31 years of marriage now, and one thing that she knows is that she's not ever to put me on the spot in a public setting, in front of people, in other words, on whether we can go do something. She knows that if we're sitting with some people and the lady's like, oh yeah, we ought to go antiquing someday up in, you know, trust me, I'm hearing that. I'm like, no, we're not. No, we're not going antiquing. You can go, but we're not. And she's like, oh, that'll be great. Yeah, let's do that. Okay, Matt, you know what the answer is guaranteed? No. Always and every time, no. And so if you talk to my wife, she's actually gotten very good about this of, well, let me check with Matt, and she'll do it later. And I'll tell her no or yeah, but I'm not going with you. You can go, but I don't antique. I hate that, or whatever it might be. My wife is also, and that husbands, I've watched this with some of you over the years. When your wife comes home and you're having dinner or whatever it is, and you're talking to her, and she informs you that, oh, yeah, by the way, we're doing such and such, and you find out you're having dinner with somebody, you're like, my conversation, this is the way mine is. Yours might be kinder or more sweet or something, but mine is, we're what? Yeah, we're going to have lunch with Bruce and Liz. And when did we talk about this? Am I right? This is the conversation, right? Well, I was talking to Liz. Okay, I'm aware that you talked to Liz, but when did we talk about this? Well, they're our friends. I know they're our friends. We're still not answering the question, when did we talk about this? Well, you want to go, don't you? No, I don't. I'm busy. I don't have time. Sorry. Call them and tell them no. But I promise. Have you ever had that, men? I promise. You know what I tell her? I don't care. Number 30, baby. Number 30. It works. Now, you can use that for evil men. And you shouldn't. So keep it in mind, all this. Remember all of last week. But it's your home, and you're responsible for it. And you own these things, and you own the decisions, and you take those responsibilities. And don't whine if you're going out to eat with somebody that you didn't want to go out to eat with because you're too busy, but you didn't say anything. It's yours, your responsibility. Your responsibility. Own it and take it, and you'll be a fine husband in that aspect. Now, with all of this, I'm definitely not going to get to the wise, so wise, relax. And by the way, if you read ahead, there's just about this much about wise, so you guys have it easy. Easy-ish. Let me ask for the slides to be brought up. Now, if you have your notes, you'll see on the last page a similar image provided for you as well. I want to talk briefly about something I learned years ago in a class on biblical worship, and it was tremendous. The professors teaching it just really helped open my eyes to the subtlety of what worship is and what it isn't. And one day when we have time, I will do a whole series on a theology of biblical worship. One of the things that really, first of all, took a huge burden off me, because I told you last week, we were never really that great at always doing family devotions. And, you know, we would do it and then we wouldn't do it. Kim and I never, it just didn't work well within our relationship and how we think and how we function. So we found it was better that we didn't read things together. But I always would have them people telling, well, you got to have this and you got to have that. And there was always a bit of a guilt that I carried. And I remember just sitting in this class, I'm like, okay, that helps. And it was an encouragement to me. So maybe this will encourage you. First of all, family worship is never emphasized in the scripture, ever. But it often is used today as an excuse for you and I to not walk in worship every moment of every day. In other words, we say, well, I had my private devotions. Now, I'm looking at pornography right now, but I had my private devotions. Like somehow this changes something. Or we had family devotions, and so we're a good family. Mind, we can't stand each other. And we're always at each other's throats, and we're in resistance to one another and whatnot. But we have our family devotions each day. What real family worship is, for your information, real family worship is when you work out the roles that are divinely ordained for you to live out. In other words, everything I've been preaching on for the last several weeks. When you take up the role of a husband and you willingly take it and you live that out, you are worshiping and you're modeling worship. You're doing true worship. Wives, when you are submitting and respecting your husbands, you are worshiping. When you care for your children and raise them in the fear and the admonition of the Lord, you are worshiping. It doesn't matter if you sat down and read four chapters together and prayed. That's not the key. The key is moment by moment that your children are watching you guys model out what it looks like to live under the mighty hand of the Lord. What we live in is this. This is our world. Pedocentric, child-centered. It's unbiblical, but it's what we live in. We have in our society a resistance to maturing and to aging. Older is always worse, always negative. This idea of honoring the gray heads is foreign in our society. But the reality is aging is a reality, and it is something that we ought to honor. We refuse to grow up, and we refuse to raise up young men and women who grow up. And in the family, the child is the focal point. That's not right. So what you have is a child, and then you have parents, a household, the broader household in the world. Everything is kind of focused toward them. So when I listen to parents, and it's like, is there a reason why your son or daughter doesn't have a job when they're, let's just say, 16? Well, you know, we got them doing this, and we want them to be involved in these things. It's like, yeah, but they're going to grow up, and they're going to get a job eventually. Do you want them to learn how to work, or is this... The idea is just to have fun. Now, I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just saying you should think about the why are you not having your children take on the responsibilities of a job and learning how to work? Why do you not give them chores? I've always laughed and puzzled in my mind when I've driven by people's house and I see a father who has sons and he's mowing the lawn. Like, you know, you got four slaves. It's just like, yeah, preacher, right? Push that. The thing that irritated me is my son married at 19. I lost mine. And my son was very quick to point out that I'm no longer under your household, Dad. I raised him well. He informed me he had his own household and keep my nose out of it, which I raised him to do. So now I started paying Andy and then Noah to start mowing my lawn. I'm like, why am I paying for this? I had a boy. When we live a life where we're allowing them to just be the center of our focus and our activities, you don't raise up a mature young man. You don't raise up a mature young daughter. This is something that we do as parents, and you need to resist. And we'll get into this in more detail. In contrast, you have the Old Testament pattern, which is a second slide. Now, this one is a patriarchal reality of ancient Israel. This is what you see, is that the father or the husband is at the center. And in the modern day, there's this whole patriarch movement, and you'll hear women of the Quiverful movement. It's a twisted distortion of the scripture. Don't get involved in it because it's messed up. And it's all about this. And that's why out of that movement, you're constantly hearing of these people who are having affairs and molestations and all kinds of other silliness, because it's a twisted idea still out of the scripture. But you see this lived out in the Old Testament, where the husband, the father, is the focal point, and everything is moving toward his well-being, his pleasures, his purposes. So the whole household looks to the father and husband as their reason for living, if you will. Now, the reality of that is abuse. So if you've ever scratched your head and said, why did Lot offer his daughters to the men? Remember, the men are trying to break down and have sex with the angels who are in the form of men. And he's like, well, no, take my daughter. Where does that come from? And you're like, well, I don't know. It's in the Bible, I guess. No, it's not. It's wrong. It's what happened. Why did Abraham twice give up his wife to a king? She's just my sister. Yeah, you can have her. Thanks, honey. You know why? Because this view, it's all about him. And a wife is merely a tool and a purpose for his own reason. And in the church today, this is why I'm beaten to death you guys. I make it hard on you men. It's because I want you to understand that's not the biblical view either. You're not raising up a daughter so that she just becomes this poor little thing that's servicing and serving and doing everything for her husband in any way that he so desires. There's a proper view, and that's the third one. In the Old Testament, the ideal was what would be called a patricentric, a father, husband-centered ideal. Oh, that's not supposed to be children. That's supposed to be in my notes. Yeah, the head of the household. So, sorry. Again, it was a bad week. I don't do graphs anyhow. So, replace that with head of the household. But what I want you to notice is the arrows. They're all going the opposite direction, right? Because what this is instead of the focus flowing toward the child, or that the focus is flowing toward the head of the household, in fact, it's flowing the other way around. What you have is the head of the household's focus is upon the well-being of others. Does this sound like New Testament stuff we've been talking about? That the husband and the father exist to bless the household, the wife, and the world. So a biblical God-honoring husband is not looking to the family for his well-being. That's a bum. A biblical father, a biblical husband, is looking to be the source of well-being for his household. So when they look at the father, the children and the wife sees a man who is laying down his life, nothing less than that, for the well-being and the good of his home. And so a man is to create an atmosphere in his household where he becomes the model on how to live. It's one where he then can invite his children to walk with him and to learn how one matures. Very different than what most of you were raised in. But it's what we are to be. It's hard. Especially with a world that goes the other way. Go ahead and turn that off. The third duty. So that's the second duty. You be responsible for the commitments of your household. The third duty as a husband is to recognize and embrace the consequence to your headship without any complaint. When we talk about the duties of a husband, Or when we talk about the duties of the Christian wife, that's not a time for you to relax. It's not like, finally, not my problem. Yes, it is. In a marriage, there are not two buckets. There's not the bucket for the husband and the bucket for the wife. And these are the husband's things and these are the wife's. You share the bucket, guys. She doesn't share your bucket, but you share hers. The husband, you are responsible for both those bucket lists. And you have to do that. You have to embrace it. You can't complain about that. You can see her responsibilities to submit or to respect or to help. And you can, through force and through anger, try to make her. Now, as a cop, I on more than one occasion would show up to a house where a furious, enraged man is there, standing over a beaten woman. I still remember this one girl who was beaten so hard by her husband that she was literally bleeding out the pores. She didn't split the skin. She was just so heavily, deeply bruised that they were oozing out. And we were really thankful that he resisted arrest. Yeah, it's just like, this is evil. This is wrong. And you know how often I would hear a man, he was just enraged. She doesn't respect me. Oh, well, this will do it. But there are many men in Christian homes who are so busy saying, but you're supposed to, and not understand that. No, 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 no. This is your home. This is your responsibility. Yeah, she should. And yes, she needs to grow in that. But why is she not? How are you correcting her? How are you dealing with that? How are you addressing these things? It cannot and ought never to be through force or anger. It always is through what God has called you to be. Love her as Christ loves the church. Nourish her. Cherish her as the head of this house. So it's the idea I talked about last week of a garden. Remember that walled garden? And your wife is the plant? And it's your job to deal with the pests and the weeds. And you're supposed to create an environment where she can flourish. That's your job, men. So you say, well, she's this and that. Well, then what are you doing? And how are you involved? Are you pulling up these weeds? And some of those, you might have an argument on your hand. You might have a wife that's not real happy with you as you're pulling the weeds because she likes that weed. I'm sorry, I always think of my wife. Not in a bad way. She has this love for what she calls her pretties. I may have told you this before. So her pretties are anything that has a flower on it. You could have the nastiest, ugliest piece of ground in our backyard, which is much of our backyard. And I don't garden. And it's there, but there's this one sad little peony that grows up every year. She loves that peony. She really does. I don't understand. It's just one. But it grows every year, and it's her pretty. And this is what she does. But that's my pretty. And I'm like, babe, let's just dig this all up and let's... No, but my pretty. If I run over one of her pretties with a lawnmower... You hear it. It's her pretty. You know, sometimes you got to rip it up. And you just got to say, sorry, it's dead. We're going to do something prettier here. And then you're going to have to do that with your wife at times. And she might not like that. But if you're doing it for the right reasons, for the right purposes, with the right goals, in the end, you will be blessed for it. This idea of embracing the consequences of your headship without complaint is huge. This idea, we don't use it that often today, but we still, you'll know what I mean. That idea of calling her your ball and chain, or you hear that whipping sound, or whatever, that's just not in the hands and in the verbiage of a Christian man. They don't belong there. You're not a man who complains and whines because you have a wife. You have found a good thing. Husbands, you need to consider your wife and how you're creating in her an environment in which she can readily and joyfully fulfill her calling and duties before the Lord. How are you doing that, men? Do you have any plan? The earlier you start, the better off you'll be. For some of you, you've not done that for years, and so you have a lot of weeds, and you're just going to have to embrace that and accept it and just start dealing with them. And in that, without bitterness, without whining or complaining, all you see is reflection of your responsibility. So ultimately, understand that the condition of your household will reflect you and your leadership. Now, some of you will have wives who make it very easy to lead, and others of you do not. Doesn't matter. For every husband, there is never a place for excuses. You are always called to own what occurs in your home. For the single man, then, that's something you should consider. If you find yourself still prone to excuse-making, singles, you're not ready for marriage. So grow up and stop making excuses, and then you can start looking for the wife. But you're not ready. If you're not ready to own your own responsibility, Lord, you don't need another sinner helping. And if you didn't know, after you get her, then little ones start showing up, and then you have a household of sinners. A key application, then, is in the area of decision-making. So let's say you recognize your wife is far better with financial thinking than you are. You're just not built that way, and you're thankful that your wife is. And so you're like, honey, what do you think we should do? We had this unusual bonus, and you think we should do this or that. And she's like, well, I think we should do this. And so you're like, all right, you do it, and it goes wrong. Whose fault is it? It's yours. It's always yours, guys. You said, yes, let's go with it. So don't look at her and say, you see what we did? I knew I shouldn't have listened to you. No, you did listen to her. It's your decision, not hers. It's your responsibility, not yours. You own that. And when you do that, you will create a good environment for your wife to grow in. Because she's not wondering, well, I don't want to get yelled at if it doesn't work, so I'm not telling them anything. And the wife is always hedging her bets. And that's an unsafe world. It's a safe world when it's ultimately it falls apart and she's like, I'm sorry, honey. No problem, sweetheart. It was my decision. Any of you that were in military, you understand that, right? Especially like the Navy. Who's responsible for the ship ultimately? Yeah, the captain. He doesn't know who this guy is who's, you know, just out of boot camp and dropped a nuke. You know, he's like, I had no idea this guy even existed. That doesn't matter. That guy is commissioned. He's done, right? It's his ship, everything. And all it really is a reflection of him, how he runs his ship. And it better come to his XO and his XO to the other officers until you get down to the junior officers. And then from there it flows out. There is a clear responsibility. It's the same way with you, men. It's still your responsibility. Then my last duty. Go to Colossians 3:19. We'll just briefly look at this in the few minutes we have. This is the parallel passage to Ephesians 5, and he adds something here. In verse 19, he says, husbands, love your wives. He doesn't say like Christ loves the church, but husbands, love your wives. And then he adds this, and do not be embittered against them. The last duty, men, that we will talk about is that temptation to be embittered toward your wife. Because if you haven't figured this out, your wife's going to fail you a lot. Because she's a sinner, which we've already talked about. Just like you're going to fail her a lot. Your wife will fight you. Remember, the part of the curse is your desire to rule over your husband, and he will instead rule over you. And right there you have the conflict. Remember all of that? You're going to have that. Don't ever be shocked that your wife fights you. It's part of what is going on. And you, under in the name of Christ and in the power of the Spirit, you guys need to undo that and restore the marriage as it ought to be. But it's there. You're going to find that she'll resist and complain at some point. She's not going to live up to your expectations. She's not going to live up to the hopes that you had. What you cannot ever allow, men, is bitterness in your heart. And it's unique. It's interesting. He speaks to this of husbands and not the wives here. And the reason you're not allowed to be bitter in your heart is that you're always reflecting Christ. So let me just tell you how I do it. When I allow my own heart to be given to sin and I start to grumble in my mind, or out loud, there have been times I've gotten into my car, and, you know, in my car, I'm always right when I'm alone, right? Whatever I say sounds incredibly wise and perfect. And I'm driving out on the way to church, you know, because I need to study. and I'm grumbling. I promise you, believe me or not, I trained myself early on that whenever I do that, because I do that, how I battle against it. Whenever I'm frustrated and I'm allowing that bitterness to just begin to show itself, you got to deal with it right away and this will work. If you don't, it's a battle. What you should do is allow your wife's failings at that moment, or at least what you perceive to be her failings, points you back to the supreme and infinite love of Christ toward you. If you are a Christian, Bob, you are a part of what? The church. See, no rehearsing going on here. This is all lies. Therefore, you are the church whom Christ loves, right? Are you always perfect? Yeah. Is he ever perfect? No. Two sons will give him testimony that, yeah, he's not perfect. So he's the church, in fact. When all this time we're thinking, I'm the model Christ to my wife. But the reality, also, men, is that you're also the church. You are the wife. And the church daily is failing his Lord or her Lord. The church is daily sinning against Christ. And Christ willingly took what upon himself? Her failings. The church's sins. He redeemed her from those sins. He's washing her with the water of his word. He's going to present to himself a woman, a bride, without spot or wrinkle or any blemish. Is Christ ever embittered toward his church? No. He has long ago, he embraced that she was an imperfect creature, and he took her imperfections onto himself and owned them. And so what I learned is that whenever my wife, in one way or another, doesn't meet up to what I want at that moment, and again, that can be right or wrong. I can be a selfish pig. When I'm driving down the road, I have trained myself within blocks to turn her failings and reflect upon all of the ways I fail my Lord and turn that into one, confession, and two, thanksgiving for his grace. What a good God that you put up with my stupidity day in and day out, and you continue to love me and continue to redeem me and continue to save me. What you will find is by the time I hit 39th, I am just so grateful for the grace of God. I am filled with a wonder of the mercy of a God who would redeem a sinner like me. You know who's not on my mind anymore? My wife and her whatever. By the time I hit the church, I've been praying for both me and my wife. And just asking God's blessing in our marriage and acknowledging that I don't reflect the love that I just realized God has shown on me constantly in my failings. He continues to pour out his love. And I reflect, oh, Father, I am a horrible husband. No longer is it my wife. And if you'll do that, man, you will go a long ways in protecting your heart from that temptation to become embittered, because your wife will fail you. Just like you fail Christ daily. It's okay. So, men, 2 hours now I've been beating on you, but all of it's good stuff. If you'll take the beginning all the way to the end here, and you will own this, and you'll begin to ask how you need to put this into your life, you'll do well. If you'll start to pour this, if you haven't already, into your sons, you will do well for them. You will have joy as you watch your son marry and lead his wife in truth and have standards and courage to be a man. When we turn our eyes to the wife next week, Lord willing, men, again, it's not a time for you to let down. It's a time for you to listen carefully, because these are your responsibilities. If your wife does not reflect these, what are you doing or not doing that is making that? This is presuming you have a Christian wife. Your job is to constantly do that. Your job is to create a world where your wife is safe, where she can be her. Good, bad, what doesn't matter. She is protected just as Christ protects his church every single day.